to look at. She stood up and walked to her laptop on the desk. In her Gmail account, she searched Opal's name. She opened each email with the paperclip icon. She followed them through the years, birthdays and first bikes and pictures they'd drawn. There were little video clips of them fighting in the kitchen and sleeping in their bunk beds, all in one room. The three of them crowded around a computer screen, that screen glow on their faces. There was one picture that broke her heart. The three of them lined up in front of Opal. Opal, with her static, sober, stoic stare. She looked at Jackie through all the years and all that they'd been through. "Come get them. They're yours," Opal's face said. The youngest one was half-smiling, like one of his brothers had just punched him in the arm, but Opal had told them all they better smile for the picture. The middle one looked like he was either pretending to or actually was, holding up what looked like a gang sign, with his fingers across his chest, smiling a big smile. He looked the most like Jackie's daughter, Jamie. The oldest one didn't smile. He looked like Opal. He looked like Jackie and Opal's mom, Vicky. Jackie wanted to go to them. She wanted a drink. She wanted to drink. She needed a meeting. Earlier she'd seen that the AA meeting for the conference would be on the second floor at 7:30 every night. There were always meetings at conferences, it being a mental health substance abuse prevention-based conference full of people like her, who had gotten into the field because they'd been through it and hoped to find meaning in their careers, helping other people not make the same mistakes they had. When she went to wipe sweat from her face with her sleeve, she realized the air conditioner had been turned off. She went to the AC unit and turned the cold air on high. She fell asleep, waiting to cool down. Jackie walked into the room in a hurry, thinking she was late. Three men sat in a small circle made of eight folding chairs. Behind them were snacks that nobody had touched yet. The room was a mess of fluorescent buzzing, a smallish conference room with a whiteboard on the wall in front, off-whitish light which encased them all in its flatness, which made everything feel like it was happening a decade ago on TV. Jackie went to the back table and looked at the food spread. A pot of coffee and a very old-looking auto-drip coffee maker, cheese, crackers, meat, and mini celery sticks fanned out in a circle around various dips. Jackie picked up a single stick of celery, poured herself a cup of coffee, and walked over to join the group. All of them were older native guys with long hair. Two wore baseball caps, and the one who seemed like he was probably the leader of the group wore a cowboy hat. The guy in the cowboy hat introduced himself to the group as Harvey. Jackie turned her head away. But the face, embedded in an orb of fat, the eyes and nose and mouth, they were his. Jackie wondered if Harvey recognized her, because he excused himself, said he had to go to the bathroom. Jackie texted Opal. "Guess who I'm in a meeting with right now?" Opal responded immediately. "Who?" "Harvey from Alcatraz." "Who?" "Harvey, as in father of the daughter I gave up." "No." "Yes."
"You sure?"
"Yes."
"What are you going to do?"
"IDK."
"YDK?"
"He just got back."
Opal sent a picture of the boys in their room, all of them lying the same way, with headphones on, looking up at the ceiling. This was the first picture she'd sent via text message, since Jackie told her not to, that she was only allowed to email pictures of them because of how it could mess with her day. Jackie reverse-pinched, then pinched and repeated to see each of their faces. "We'll talk to him after meeting," Jackie texted, then switched her phone to silent and put it away. Harvey sat down without looking at Jackie. With a simple hand gesture, a palm facing up, he pointed to her. Jackie wasn't sure if this not looking at her, plus the trip to the bathroom, meant that he knew. Either way, it was her turn to tell her story, or share whatever she felt like. And he would know as soon as she said her name. Jackie rested her elbows on her knees, leaned into the group. "My name is Jackie Redfeather. I don't say the I'm an alcoholic thing. I say I don't drink anymore. I used to drink, and now I don't. I currently have 11 days sobriety. I'm grateful to be here and for your time. Thank you all for listening. I appreciate all of you being here." Jackie coughed, her throat suddenly rough. She put a cough drop into her mouth so casually that you could tell she probably ate a lot of cough drops and smoked a lot of cigarettes, and never quite beat the cough, but beat it enough while she was sucking on a cough drop and so ate them constantly. "The problem that became a drinking problem started for me way before the drinking was even related to it, though it was when I first started drinking. Not that I blame my past or don't accept it. We'd been on Alcatraz, me and my family, back during the occupation in 1970. It all started for me there. This piece of shit kid," Jackie made sure to look right at Harvey after she said this. He squirmed in his chair a little, but otherwise just stared off toward the ground in a listening pose. Maybe he didn't know what he was doing, but then again, maybe he went on to fuck over a whole line of women, used force to stretch a no into a yes. Assholes like him, I know now, are a dime a dozen. But I suspect from what little time I spent with him on that island that he went on to do it again and again. After my mom died, we lived in a house with a stranger, a distant relative, which I'm grateful for. We had food on the table, a roof over our heads. But I gave up a daughter to adoption at that time. The girl I birthed came from that island, from what happened there. When I gave her up, I was 17. I was stupid. I wouldn't know how to find her now, even if I wanted to. It was a closed adoption. And since then, I have had another daughter. But I fucked that up, too, in my addiction. Fifth a night of anything $10 or less. And it got so bad, they told me I had to quit if I wanted to keep my job. And then, as it goes, to keep being able to drink, I quit my job. My daughter Jamie was out of the house by then, so it was easier for me to fall completely apart. Insert endless succession of drinking horror stories here. Today I'm trying to make my way back. My daughter died, left her 3 sons behind. But I left them too. I'm trying to make my way back, but like I said, 11 days. It's that you get stuck. And then the more stuck you get, the more stuck you get. Jackie coughed and cleared her throat, then went silent. She looked up at Harvey, at the others in the group, but their heads were all down. She didn't want to end on that kind of note, but she didn't feel like going on. "I don't know," she said. "I guess I'm done." The circle was silent. Harvey cleared his throat. "Thank you," Harvey said. He gestured for the next guy to speak. He was an old guy, Navajo, Jackie guessed. He took his hat off like you see some Indian men do when they pray. "It all changed for me in a meeting," he said. "Not one of these. These have been what's made all the difference since. I'd been drinking and drugging for most of my adult life, off and on. Started a few different families up, let them fall by the wayside to my addictions. And then a brother of mine put up a meeting for me. Native American church." Jackie stopped listening. She thought it would help to say what she said about Harvey in front of him. But looking at him, listening to people's stories, she figured he'd probably had a hard time. Jackie remembered the way he'd talked about his dad on the island, how he hadn't even seen his dad since they got on the island. Then, thinking about the island, Jackie remembered seeing Harvey the day they left. She'd just gotten on the boat, and she saw him in the water. Hardly anyone ever got in that water. It was freezing, and everyone had been convinced shark-infested. Then Jackie saw Harvey's little brother, Rocky, running down the hill yelling Harvey's name. The boat started up. Everyone had sat down, but Jackie was standing. Jackie's mom put her hand on Jackie's shoulder. She must have thought Jackie was sad because she let her stay standing for a few minutes. Harvey wasn't swimming. He seemed to be hiding in the water. And then he was yelling for his brother. Rocky heard him, and he jumped in with all his clothes on. The boat started to move. "Okay, we're going. Sit down now, Jackie," Vicky said. Jackie sat down but kept looking. She saw the boy's dad stumble down the hill. He had something in his hand, a stick or a bat. Everything got smaller and smaller as they made their way slowly across the bay. "We all been through a lot we don't understand, in a world made to either break us or make us so hard we can't break, even when it's what we need most to do." It was Harvey talking. Jackie realized she hadn't been listening. "Getting fucked up seems like the only thing left to do," Harvey went on. "It's not the alcohol. There's not some special relationship between Indians and alcohol. It's just what's cheap, available, legal. It's what we have to go to when it seems like we have nothing else left. I did it, too, for a long time. But I stopped telling the story I'd been telling myself about how that was the only way because of how hard I had it and how hard I was. That story about self-medicating against the disease that was my life, my bad lot, history. When we see that the story is the way we live our lives, only then can we start to change, a day at a time. We try to help people like us, try to make the world around us a little better. It's then that the story begins. I want to say here that I'm sorry for who I was." Harvey looked up at Jackie, who turned away from his gaze. "I get that shame, too. The kind that's made of more years than you know you have left to live. That shame that makes you want to say fuck it and just go back to drinking as a means to an end. I'm sorry to all the people I hurt all that time I was too fucked up to see what I was doing. There's no excuse. Apologies don't even mean as much as just acknowledging that you fucked up, hurt people, and that you don't want to do that anymore. Not to yourself, either. That's sometimes the hardest part. So let's close out tonight like we always do, but let's be sure to listen to the prayer and say it like we mean it. God, grant me the serenity." They were all saying it in unison. Jackie wasn't going to at first, but suddenly found that she was saying it with them. "And wisdom to know the difference," she finished. The room cleared out. Everyone but the two of them, Jackie and Harvey. Jackie sat with her hands in a pile in her lap. She couldn't move. "Long time," Harvey said. "Yeah. You know, I'm going back to Oakland this summer, in a couple months, actually, for the powwow. But also, is this supposed to go like we're normal, fine, like old friends? Did you not stay to talk?" "I don't know why I stayed yet. I know you said what we did, what I did on Alcatraz, how you put her up for adoption, and I'm sorry for all that. I couldn't have known. I just found out I have a son, too. He got a hold of me through Facebook. He lives in..." "What are you talking about?" Jackie said, then stood up to leave. "Can we start over? I don't give a shit about your son or your life." "Is there any way to find out?" "Find out what?" "Our daughter." "Don't call her that. She might want to know." It'll be better for everyone if she doesn't.
What about your grandsons?
Don't.
We don't have to keep doing this, Harvey said, and took off his hat. He was bald on top.
He stood up and put his hat on his chair.
What are you going to say to him? Jackie said.
About what?
About where you been.
I didn't know.
Listen, Jackie, I think you should think about coming back with me to Oakland.
We don't even know each other.
It's a free ride. We'll drive all day and then through the night till we get there.
You got all the answers, then?
I want to do something to help. There's no way to take back what I done to you, but I gotta try.
How long you been sober? Jackie said.
Since 1982.
Well, shit.
Those boys need their grandma.
I don't know.
And you sure as hell don't know a goddamn thing about my life.
We might be able to find her.
No. There are ways of...
God, shut the fuck up! Stop acting like you know me. Like we even have anything to say to each other. Like we wanted to find each other. Like we didn't just...
Jackie stopped herself and stood up and walked out of the room. Harvey caught up with her at the elevator.
Jackie, I'm sorry, please, he said.
Please what?
I'm going now, she said, and pushed the already lit call button.
You don't want to be sorry about this later, Harvey said. You don't want to keep going that same way you've been going.
You can't really think you're going to be the one who finally turns it all around for me. I would fucking kill myself if you were the one to finally help. Do you understand that?
The elevator came and Jackie got on.
There's got to be some reason for all this, that we would meet like this, Harvey said, holding the elevator by putting his arm across the threshold. The reason is we're both fuck-ups and the Indian world is small.
Don't come with me then, that's fine. Don't even listen to me.
But you said it in the circle. You know what you want. You said it. You want to go back.
Okay, Jackie said.
Okay, Harvey said.
Okay, you'll come back?
I'll think about it, she said.
Harvey let go of the elevator doors. Back in her room, Jackie lay down on the bed. She put a pillow over her face. Then, without even thinking about it, she got up and went to the mini-fridge. She opened it. It was full of shots, beer, little bottles of wine. At first, this made her happy. The idea of feeling good and comfortable, safe, and all the first six could do. And then the inevitable home stretch to 12, 16, because the web stuck to you everywhere you reached once you were trapped, once you started. Jackie closed the fridge, then reached behind it and unplugged it. She slid the fridge out from under the TV. Then, using all of her strength, she walked the thing to the door. The bottles clanged as if in protest. Slowly, corner to corner, she made her way. She left the mini-fridge outside in the hallway, then came back in and called the front desk to tell them to come get it. She was sweating. She still wanted a drink. There was still time before they'd be up to get it. She needed to leave. She put on her swimsuit. Jackie stepped around the mini-fridge, walked down the hall, realized she forgot her cigarettes, then turned around and went back for them. When she came back out of her room, the fridge caught her shin.
Fuck, she said, looking down at the fridge. You!
She looked to see if anyone was coming. Then opened the fridge and pulled out a bottle. Then another. She rolled 6 of them into her towel. Then 10. In the elevator, she held the bundle of bottles with both arms. She walked back to the empty pool, climbed in, and stayed under until it hurt. Every time she came up, she checked on the towel bundle. There's an ache when you keep yourself from breathing, a relief when you come up for air. It was the same when you drank after telling yourself you wouldn't. Both broke at a point. Both gave and took. Jackie went under and swam back and forth, taking breaths when she needed them. She thought about her grandsons, that picture of them with Opal,
Opal's face. Her eyes saying to Jackie, "Come get them."
Jackie got out of the pool and went to the towel. She heaved the bundle back, then threw it high into the air, into the water. She watched the white towel slowly float down to the water, then lay flat. She watched the bottles sink to the bottom. She turned around, went out the gate, and back up to her room. The text she sent Opal was just this: "If I come to Oakland, can I stay?"
Orville Redfeather. Orville stands in front of Opal's bedroom mirror with his regalia on, all wrong. It isn't backward, and actually he doesn't know what he did wrong, but it's off. He moves in front of the mirror and his feathers shake. He catches the hesitation, the worry in his eyes, there in the mirror. He worries suddenly that Opal might come into her room where Orville is doing what? There would be too much to explain. He wonders what she would do if she caught him. Ever since they were in her care, Opal had been openly against any of them doing anything Indian. She treated it all like it was something they could decide for themselves when they were old enough, like drinking, or driving, or smoking, or voting. Indianing. "Too many risks," she said, "especially around powwows. Boys like you? No." Orville couldn't fathom what she meant by risks. He'd found the regalia by accident in her closet many years ago while searching for Christmas presents. He'd asked her why she didn't teach them anything about being Indian. "Cheyenne way, we let you learn for yourself, then teach you when you're ready." "That doesn't make any sense," Orville had said. "If we learn for ourselves, we don't need to be taught. It's 'cause you're always working." He saw his grandma's head turn from the pot she was stirring. He quickly pulled out a chair and sat down. "Don't make me say it, Orville," she said. "I get so tired of hearing myself say it. You know how much I work, how late I come home. I got my route and the mail doesn't stop coming just like the bills don't. Your phones, the internet, electricity, food. There's rent and clothes and bus and train money. Listen, baby, it makes me happy you want to know. But learning about your heritage is a privilege. A privilege we don't have. And anyway, anything you hear from me about your heritage does not make you more or less Indian. More or less a real Indian. Don't ever let anyone tell you what being Indian means. Too many of us died to get just a little bit of us here, right now, right in this kitchen. You. Me. Every part of our people that made it is precious. You're Indian because you're Indian because you're Indian," she said, ending the conversation by turning back around to stir. "So if we had more money, if you didn't have to work so much, things would be different," Orville said. "You didn't hear a thing I said to you, did you?" she said. Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield. Big old name for a big old lady. She's not technically their grandma. Indian way she is. That's what she told them when she explained why she was a bear shield and they were red feathers. She is actually their great aunt. Their real grandma, Jackie Redfeather, lives in New Mexico. Opal is Jackie's half-sister, but they grew up together, with the same mom. Jackie's daughter Jamie is the boy's mom. But all Jamie ever did was push them out. Didn't even quit using when they were in her. The three of them had all begun life in withdrawal. Heroin babies. Jamie shot herself between the eyes when Orville was 6, his brothers 4 and 2. Opal officially adopted them after their mom died, but she'd had them plenty before that. Orville only has a handful of memories of his mom. He'd overheard these details when his grandma was talking to a friend on the kitchen phone late one night. "Tell us something about her," Orville would say whenever he got the chance, moments when Opal was in a good mood and it seemed like she'd answer. "She's how you all got those lousy spellings of your names," Opal told the boys over dinner one night after Lonnie told them the kids were calling him Loney the Pony at school. "Nobody says it right," Lonnie said. "She did that?" Orville said. "Of course she did. Who else? Not that she was stupid. She knew how to spell. She just wanted you all to be different. I don't blame her. Our name should look different. She was fucking stupid, Luther said. That shit's weak. He stood up, pushed his chair back, and walked out of the room. He'd always complained the most about the spelling of his name, even though people still pronounced it right. No one had ever even noticed that Orville was supposed to be spelled O-R-V-I-L-L-E, with that useless extra L and E. As for Lonnie, it was only because Opal knew their mom, knew how she said it, that anyone anywhere knew it wasn't supposed to be Loney as in pony. Orville manages to get the regalia on and steps in front of the full-length mirror on Opal's closet door. Mirrors have always been a problem for him. The word stupid often sounds in his head when he looks at himself in the mirror. He doesn't know why, but it seems important. And true. The regalia is itchy and faded in color. It's way too small. He doesn't look the way he hoped he would. He doesn't know what he expected to find. Being Indian didn't fit either. And virtually everything Orville learned about being Indian, he'd learned virtually. From watching hours and hours of powwow footage, documentaries on YouTube, by reading all that there was to read on sites like Wikipedia, powwows.com, and Indian Country Today. Googling stuff like, what does it mean to be a real Indian? Which led him several clicks through some pretty fucked up, judgmental forums, and finally to an UrbanDictionary.com word he'd never heard before. Pretendian. Orville knew he wanted to dance the first time he saw Dancer on TV. He was 12. It was November, so it was easy to find Indians on TV. Everyone else had gone to bed. He was flipping through channels when he found him. There on the screen, in full regalia. The dancer moved like gravity meant something different for him. It was like breakdancing in a way, Orville thought, but both new, even cool, and ancient-seeming. There was so much he'd missed, hadn't been given, hadn't been told. In that moment, in front of the TV, he knew. He was a part of something, something you could dance to. And so what Orville is, according to himself, standing in front of the mirror with his too-small-for-him stolen regalia, is dressed up like an Indian. In hides and ties, ribbons and feathers, boned breastplate and hunched shoulders, he stands, weak in the knees, a fake, a copy, a boy playing dress-up. And yet there's something there. Behind that stupid, glazed-over stare, the one he so often gives his brothers, that critical, cruel look, behind that, he can almost see it. Which is why he keeps looking, keeps standing in front of the mirror. He's waiting for something true to appear before him, about him. It's important that he dress like an Indian, dance like an Indian, even if it is an act, even if he feels like a fraud the whole time. Because the only way to be Indian in this world is to look and act like an Indian. To be or not to be Indian depends on it. Today, the Redfeather brothers are going to get Lonnie a new bike. On the way, they stop at the Indian Center. Orville's supposed to be getting $200 to tell a story for a storytelling project he read about on Facebook. Luther and Lonnie sit outside in the hall while Orville is led into a room by a guy who introduced himself as Dean Oxendean. Dean sits Orville down in front of a camera. He sits behind the camera, crosses his legs, leans in toward Orville. Can you tell me your name, your age, and where you're from? Dean says. Okay. Orville Redfeather, 14, Oakland. What about your tribe? Do you know what tribe you are? Cheyenne, from our mom's side. And how do you find out about this project? Facebook. Said it paid $200? That's right. I'm here to collect stories in order to have them available online for people from our community and communities like ours to hear and see. When you hear stories from people like you, you feel less alone. When you feel less alone and like you have a community of people behind you, alongside you, I believe you can live a better life. Does that make sense? Sure. What does it mean to you when I say story? I don't know. Orville says. Without thinking about it, he crosses his legs like Dean. Try. It's just telling other people something that happened to you. Good. That's basically it. Now tell me something that happened to you. Like what? That's up to you. It's just like you said. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Tell me something that's happened to you that stands out, that you thought of right away. Me and my brothers? How we ended up with our grandma, who we live with now? It was after the first time we thought our mom overdosed. Would you mind talking about that day? I barely remember anything from when I was younger. But I remember that day perfectly. It was a Saturday, so me and my brothers had been watching cartoons all morning. I went to the kitchen to make us sandwiches, and I found her face down on the kitchen floor. Her nose was all smashed into the floor and bleeding. And I knew it was bad because her arms were curled up at her stomach like she'd fallen down on top of them, which meant she nodded out walking. First thing I did was send my brothers to the front yard. We were living off of 38th then, in a little blue house with this tiny gated patch of grass that we were still small and young enough to like playing on. I got out Mom's makeup mirror and put it under her nose. I'd seen that on a show, and when I saw that it barely fogged up, I called 911. When they came, because I told the operator about how it was just me and my brothers besides our mom, they came with two cop cars and a CPS worker. He was this old Indian guy I never saw again except for that one time. It was the first time I heard that we were Indian. He recognized that we were Indian just by looking at us. They carried our mom out on a stretcher while the social worker showed my little brothers a magic trick with a book of matches. Or he was just lighting matches and it felt like magic. I don't know. He's the reason they called our grandma and why we ended up getting adopted by her. He took us to his office and asked who else there was besides our mom. After talking to our grandma, Opal, we left and met her at the hospital. And then we went home with her. Home with your grandma? Yeah. And your mom? She'd already left the hospital by the time we got there. Turned out she just got knocked out from the fall. She didn't overdose. That's a good story. Thank you. I mean, not good, but thank you for telling it. I get $200 now? Orville and his brothers leave the Indian Center and go straight to Target in West Oakland to get Lonnie's bike. Lonnie rides on the back of Luther's bike, on pegs. Even though the story had been sad to remember, Orville feels okay about having told it. He feels even better about the $200 gift card in his back pocket. He can't stop smiling. But his leg. The lump that's been in his leg for as long as he can remember, as of late it's been itching. He hasn't been able to stop scratching it. Some shit just went down in the bathroom, Orville tells Luther when he gets outside Target. Isn't that what it's supposed to do? Luther says. Shut the fuck up, Luther. I'm serious, Orville says. What? You didn't make it in time? Luther says. I was sitting there in the stall, picking at that thing. You remember that lump I got? I felt something poking out of it, so I pulled. Like, I just pulled one out. Put it on some folded-up toilet paper, then went back in and got another one. Then one more after that. Pretty sure they're spider legs, Orville says. Luther says and laughs. At which point Orville shows him a neat pile of folds of toilet paper. Let me see, Luther says. Orville opens up the folds of toilet paper and shows Luther. What the fuck? Luther says. Right out of my leg, Orville says. Are you sure it's not, like, splinters? Nah, look where the leg bends. There's a joint and a tip, like the end of the leg where it gets skinnier, look. That's fucked up, Luther says. But what about the other five? I mean, if they're spider legs, there should be eight, right? Before Orville can say anything else or put away the spider legs, Luther's on his phone. You looking it up? Orville asks him. But Luther doesn't answer. He just taps. Scrolls. Waits. You find anything? Orville says. Nah, not even a little bit, Luther says. When Lonnie comes out with his bike, Orville and Luther look down at it and nod. Lonnie smiles at their nods. Let's go, Orville says, then puts his earphones in. He looks back and sees his brothers put theirs in too. They ride back toward Wood Street. As they pass the Target sign, Orville remembers last year when they all got phones at Target on the same day as an early Christmas present. They were the cheapest phones they had, but at least they weren't flip phones. They were smart. They do all they need them to do. make calls, text, play music, and get them on the internet. They ride together in a line and listen to what comes out of their phones. Orville mainly listens to powwow music. There's something in the energy of that big booming drum, in the intensity of the singing, like an urgency that feels specifically Indian. He likes the power the sound of a chorus of voices makes, too. Those high-pitched wailed harmonies, how you can't tell how many singers there are, and how sometimes it sounds like 10 singers, sometimes like 100. There was even one time, when he was dancing in Opal's room with his eyes closed, when he felt like it was all his ancestors who made it so he could be there dancing and listening to that sound, singing right there in his ears through all those hard years they made it through. But that moment was also the first time his brothers saw him in regalia, dancing like that. They walked in on him in the middle of it, and they thought it was hilarious. They laughed and laughed, but promised not to tell Opal. As for Luther, not counting himself, he listens exclusively to three rappers: Chance the Rapper, Eminem, and Earl Sweatshirt. Luther writes and records his own raps to instrumentals he finds on YouTube, and makes Orville and Lonnie listen to them and agree with him about how good he is. As for Lonnie, they'd recently discovered what he's into. "You hear that?" Luther had asked one night in their room. "Yeah, it's like some kind of chorus or choir, right?" Orville said. "Yeah, like angels or some shit," Luther said. "Angels," Orville said. "Yeah, like what they have them sound like." "What they have them sound like?" "I mean like movies and shit," Luther said. "Shut up. It's still going. Listen." They sat for the next couple of minutes and listened to the distant sound of the symphony, of the choir coming through an inch of speaker muted by Lonnie's ears, ready to believe it was anything, anything better than the sound they had the angels make. It hit Orville first what the sound was, and he started to say Lonnie's name, but Luther got up, put a finger to his lips, then went over and gently pulled Lonnie's earphones out. He put one of them close to his ear and smiled. He looked at Lonnie's phone and smiled bigger and showed it to Orville. "Beethoven?" Orville said. They ride up 14th toward downtown. 14th takes them through downtown to East 12th, which gets them to the Fruitvale without a bike lane, but on a street big enough so that even though cars get comfortable, swerve a little, and go faster on East 12th, it's better than riding the gutter edge of International Boulevard. When they get to Fruitvale and International, they stop in the Wendy's parking lot. Orville and Luther take out their phones. "Guys, seriously? Orville had spider legs in his leg? What the fuck?" Lonnie asks. Orville and Luther look at each other and laugh hard. Lonnie hardly ever curses, so when he does, it's always both super serious and funny to hear. "Come on," Lonnie says. "It's real, Lonnie," Orville says. "What does that mean, it's real?" Lonnie says. "We don't know," Orville says. "Call Grandma," Lonnie says. "And say what?" Luther says. "Tell her," Lonnie says. "She'll make it a big deal," Orville says. "What'd the internet say?" Lonnie asks. Luther just shakes his head. "Seems Indian," Orville says. "What?" Luther says. "Spiders and shit," Orville says. "Definitely Indian," Lonnie says. "Maybe you should call," Luther says. "Fuck," Orville says. "But the powwow's tomorrow." "What does that have to do with it?" Luther says. "You're right," Orville says. "It's not like she knows we're going." Orville leaves a message for his grandma when she doesn't pick up. He tells her they got Lonnie's bike, and then about the spider legs. While he leaves the message, he watches Luther and Lonnie look at the legs together. They poke at the legs and move the toilet paper so that the legs bend. Orville feels a pulse in his stomach, and like something falls out of him. After he hangs up, he takes the legs, folds up the toilet paper, and stuffs it in his pocket. The day of the powwow, Orville wakes up hot. He covers his face with the cold bottom of his pillow. He thinks about the powwow, then lifts the pillow and tilts his head to listen to what he thinks he hears from out in the kitchen. He wants to minimize their time with Opal before they go. He wakes his brothers up by hitting them with his pillow. They both moan and roll over, so he hits them again. "We gotta get out without having to talk to her. She might have made us breakfast. We'll tell her we're not hungry." "But I am hungry," Lonnie says. "Don't we want to hear what she thinks about the spider legs?" Luther says. "No," Orville says. We don't. Not now. I really don't think she'll care we're going to the powwow, Luther says. Maybe, Orville says. But what if she does? Orville and his brothers ride their bikes down San Leandro Boulevard on the sidewalk in a line. At the Coliseum BART station, they lift their bikes and carry them on their shoulders, then ride across the pedestrian bridge that gets them to the Coliseum. They slow to a roll. Orville looks through the chain-link fence and sees the morning fog clearing to blue. Orville leads his brothers clockwise around the outer edge of the parking lot. He stands and pedals hard, and takes off his plain black hat and stuffs it into his hoodie's front pocket. After getting some speed, he stops pedaling, takes his hands off the handlebars, and grabs hold of his hair. It's gotten long, down to the middle of his back long. He ties his hair back with a beaded hair clip that he'd found with the regalia in his grandma's closet. He pulls his ponytail through the half circle in the back of his hat, which latches with the snaps of 6 small black plastic buttons in a line. He likes the sound, the feel of it when he can get them to snap down perfectly in a row. He picks up speed again, then coasts and looks back. Lonnie's in the back with his tongue sticking out from how hard he's pedaling. Luther's taking pictures of the Coliseum with his phone. The Coliseum looks massive. Bigger than it looks when you see it from BART, or driving by on the freeway. Orville's gonna dance on the same field that the A's and the Raiders play on. He'll compete as a dancer. He'll dance the dance he learned by watching powwow footage on YouTube. It's his first powwow. Can we stop? Lonnie says, out of breath. They stop halfway around the parking lot. I gotta ask you guys something, Lonnie says.
Just ask then, homie, Luther says.
Shut up, Luther. What's up, Lonnie? Orville says, looking at Luther. I've been meaning to ask, Lonnie says. Like, what's a powwow? Luther laughs, takes off his hat and hits it against his bike. Lonnie, we've seen hella powwows. What do you mean, what's a powwow? Orville says. Yeah, but I never asked nobody, Lonnie says. I didn't know what we were looking at. Lonnie tugs at the bill of his black and yellow A's cap to pull his head down. Orville looks up at the sound of a plane passing overhead. I mean, why does everyone dress up, dance, and sing Indian? Lonnie says. Lonnie, Luther says, in that way an older brother can take you down by just saying your name. Never mind, Lonnie says. No, Orville says. Every time I ask questions, you guys make me feel stupid for asking, Lonnie says.
Yeah, but, Lonnie, you ask hella stupid questions, Luther says. Sometimes it's hard to know what to say.
Then say it's hard to know what to say, Lonnie says, squeezing his handbrake. He swallows hard, watching his hand grip the handbrake, then leans down to watch the brakes grip the front tire. They're just old ways, Lonnie. Dancing, singing Indian. We gotta carry it on. Orville says.
Why?
Lonnie says. If we don't, they might disappear, Orville says.
Disappear? Where are they gonna go? I mean, like, people will forget.
Why can't we just make up our own ways? Lonnie says. Orville puts his hand across his forehead the same way their grandma does when she's frustrated.
Lonnie, you like the taste of Indian tacos, right?
Orville says.
Yeah, Lonnie says.
Would you just make up some food of your own and eat it? Orville says.
That actually sounds pretty fun, Lonnie says, still looking down but smiling a little now, which makes Orville laugh and say the word stupid in the middle of his laugh.
Luther laughs too, but he's already looking at his phone. They get back on their bikes, then look up and see lines of cars streaming in, hundreds of people getting out of their cars. The boys stop. Orville gets off his bike. These are other Indians, getting out of their cars. Some of them already in full regalia. Real Indians like they'd never seen before, if you didn't count their grandma, who they probably should count, except that it was too hard for them to tell what was specifically Indian about her. She was all they knew besides their mom, who's too hard to think about or remember. Opal worked for the post office, delivered mail. She liked to watch TV when she was home, cook for them. They didn't know much else about her. She did make fried bread for them on special occasions.
Orville pulls at the nylon straps of his backpack to tighten it and lets go of the handlebars. Lets the front wheel wobble, but balances by leaning back. In the backpack is the regalia that barely fits, his extra-extra-large black hoodie, which was too big for him on purpose, and three now squished peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in Ziploc plastic baggies he hopes they won't have to eat, but he knows they might have to if the Indian tacos are too expensive, if food prices are anything like the food at A's games when it's not dollar night. They only knew about Indian tacos because their grandma made them for their birthdays. It was one of the few Indian things she did. And she was always sure to remind them that it's not traditional, and that it comes from lacking resources and wanting comfort food. To be sure they'd at least be able to afford an Indian taco each, they rode their bikes up to the fountain behind the Mormon temple. Luther had just been there for a field trip to Joaquin Miller Park, and he said people threw coins in for wishes. They made Lonnie roll up his pants and gather all the coins he could see, while Orville and Luther threw rocks at the community building at the top of the stairs above the fountain. A distraction they didn't see at the time might have been worse than the fountain scraping itself. Going down Lincoln Avenue after that was one of the best and stupidest things they'd ever done together. You could get going so fast down a hill, there was nothing else happening in the whole world but the feeling of the speed moving through you and the wind in your eyes. They went to Bayfair Center in San Leandro and scraped out what they could from that fountain before being chased off by a security guard. They took the bus up to the Lawrence Hall of Science in the Berkeley Hills, where there was a double fountain, which they knew would be practically untouched because only rich people or monitored kids on field trips went to that place. After rolling up all the coins and turning them in at the bank, they came away with a total of $14.91. When they get to the entrance at the Coliseum, Orville looks back at Luther and asks if he has the lock. "You always bring it," Luther says. "I asked you to get it before we left the house. I said, Luther, can you get the lock? I don't want it messing up my regalia." "You seriously didn't bring it?" "Fuck. What are we gonna do? I asked you right before we left the house. You said, yeah, I got it. Luther, you said, yeah, I got it." "I must have been talking about something else," Luther says. Orville breathes out the word okay and signals for them to follow him. They hide their bikes in some bushes on the other side of the Coliseum. "Grandma'll kill us if we lose our bikes," Lonnie says. "Well, there's no not going," Orville says, "so we're going."
Interlude. What strange phenomena we find in a great city. All we need do is stroll about with our eyes open. Life swarms with innocent monsters. Charles Baudelaire. Powwows. For powwows, we come from all over the country. From reservations and cities, from rancherias, forts, pueblos, lagoons, and off-reservation trust lands. We come from towns on the sides of highways in northern Nevada with names like Winnemucca. Some of us come all the way out from Oklahoma, South Dakota, Arizona, New Mexico, Montana, Minnesota. We come from Phoenix, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, New York City, Pine Ridge, Fort Apache, Gila River, Pitt River, the Osage Reservation, Rosebud, Flathead, Red Lake, San Carlos, Turtle Mountain, the Navajo Reservation. To get to powwows, we drive alone and in pairs on road trips. We caravan as families, piled in station wagons, vans, and in the backs of Ford Broncos. Some of us smoke 2 packs a day if we're driving, or drink beer continually to keep ourselves occupied. Some of us, who gave up that tired life on that long red road of sobriety, we drink coffee. We sing, pray, and tell stories until we run out. We lie, cheat, and steal our stories, sweat and bleed them out along the highway, until that long white line makes us quiet, makes us pull over to sleep. When we get tired, we stop at motels and hotels. We sleep in our cars on the side of the road, at rest stops and truck stops, in Walmart parking lots. We are young people and old, every kind of Indian in between. We made powwows because we needed a place to be together. Something intertribal. Something old. Something to make us money. Something we could work toward, for our jewelry, our songs, our dances, our drum. We keep powwowing because there aren't very many places where we get to all be together, where we get to see and hear each other. We all came to the Big Oakland Powwow for different reasons. The messy, dangling strands of our lives got pulled into a braid, tied to the back of everything we'd been doing all along to get us here. We've been coming for miles. And we've been coming for years, generations, lifetimes, layered in prayer and hand-woven regalia, beaded and sewn together, feathered, braided, blessed, and cursed. Big Oakland Powwow. In the Oakland Coliseum parking lot, for the Big Oakland Powwow, there is one thing that makes many of our cars the same. Our bumpers and rear windows are covered with Indian stickers like, "We're still here," and "My other vehicle is a war pony," and "Sure you can trust the government, just ask an Indian." Custer had it coming. We do not inherit the earth from our ancestors, we borrow it from our children. Fighting terrorism since 1492. And "My child didn't make the honor list, but she sure can sing an honor song." There are Schimmel Sister stickers, and Navajo Nation stickers, Cherokee Nation stickers, Idle No More, and AIM flags duct-taped to antennas. There are dream catchers and tiny moccasins, feathers and beaded miscellany hanging from rear-view mirrors. We are Indians, and Native Americans, American Indians, and Native American Indians, North American Indians, Natives, NDNs, and Indians, status Indians and non-status Indians, First Nations Indians, and Indians so Indian we either think about the fact of it every single day, or we never think about it at all. We are urban Indians and indigenous Indians, res Indians, and Indians from Mexico and Central and South America. We are Alaskan Native Indians, Native Hawaiians, and European expatriate Indians. Indians from 8 different tribes with quarter-blood quantum requirements, and so not federally recognized Indian kinds of Indians. We are enrolled members of tribes and disenrolled members, ineligible members and tribal council members. We are full-blood, half-breed, quadroon, eighths, sixteenths, 32nds, undoable math, insignificant remainders. Blood. Blood is messy when it comes out. Inside it runs clean and looks blue in tubes that line our bodies, that split and branch like Earth's river systems. Blood is 90% water. And like water, it must move. Blood must flow. Never stray or split or clot or divide. Lose any essential amount of itself while it distributes evenly through our bodies. But blood is messy when it comes out. It dries, divides, and cracks in the air. Native blood quantum was introduced in 1705 at the Virginia colony. If you were at least half native, you didn't have the same rights as white people. Blood quantum and tribal membership qualifications have since been turned over to individual tribes to decide. In the late 1990s, Saddam Hussein commissioned a Quran to be written in his own blood. Now, Muslim leaders aren't sure what to do with it. To have written the Quran in blood was a sin, but to destroy it would also be a sin. The wound that was made when white people came and took all that they took has never healed. An unattended wound gets infected, becomes a new kind of wound, like the history of what actually happened became a new kind of history. All these stories that we haven't been telling all this time, that we haven't been listening to, are just part of what we need to heal. Not that we're broken. And don't make the mistake of calling us resilient. To not have been destroyed, to not have given up, to have survived, is no badge of honor. Would you call an attempted murder victim resilient? When we go to tell our stories, people think we wanted to have gone different. People want to say things like "sore losers" and "move on already," quit playing the blame game. But is it a game? Only those who have lost as much as we have see the particularly nasty slice of smile on someone who thinks they're winning when they say, "get over it." This is the thing. If you have the option to not think about or even consider history, whether you learned it right or not, or whether it even deserves consideration, that's how you know you're on board the ship that serves hors d'oeuvres and fluffs your pillows, while others are out at sea, swimming or drowning, or clinging to little inflatable rafts that they have to take turns keeping inflated. People short of breath, who've never even heard of the words hors d'oeuvres or fluff. Then someone from up on the yacht says, "It's too bad those people down there are lazy, and not as smart and able as we are up here. We who have built these strong, large, stylish boats ourselves. We who float the seven seas like kings." And then someone else on board says something like, "But your father gave you this yacht. And these are his servants who brought the hors d'oeuvres." At which point that person gets tossed overboard by a group of hired thugs who'd been hired by the father who owned the yacht, hired for the express purpose of removing any and all agitators on the yacht to keep them from making unnecessary waves, or even referencing the father or the yacht itself. Meanwhile, the man thrown overboard begs for his life, and the people on the small inflatable rafts can't get to him soon enough, or they don't even try. And the yacht's speed and weight cause an undertow. Then in whispers, while the agitator gets sucked under the yacht, private agreements are made, precautions are measured out, and everyone quietly agrees to keep on quietly agreeing to the implied rule of law and to not think about what just happened. Soon, the father who put these things in place is only spoken of in the form of lore, stories told to children at night, under the stars, at which point there are suddenly several fathers, noble, wise forefathers, and the boat sails on unfettered. If you were fortunate enough to be born into a family whose ancestors directly benefited from genocide and/or slavery, maybe you think the more you don't know, the more innocent you can stay, which is a good incentive to not find out, to not look too deep, to walk carefully around the sleeping tiger. Look no further than your last name. Follow back and you might find your line paved with gold or beset with traps. Last names. We didn't have last names before they came. When they decided they needed to keep track of us, last names were given to us. Just like the name Indian itself was given to us. These were attempted translations and botched Indian names, random surnames, and names passed down from white American generals, admirals, and colonels, and sometimes troop names, which were sometimes just colors. That's how we are blacks and browns, greens, whites, and oranges. We are Smiths, Lees, Scots, MacArthurs, Shermans, Johnsons, Jacksons. Our names are poems, descriptions of animals, images that make perfect sense and no sense at all. We are Little Cloud, Littleman, Loneman, Bull Coming, Mad Bull, Bad Heart Bull, Jumping Bull, Bird, Bird's Head, Kingbird, Magpie, Eagle, Turtle, Crow, Beaver, Youngblood, Tallman, Eastman, Hoffman, Flying Out, Has No Horse, Broken Leg, Fingernail, Left Hand, Elk Shoulder, White Eagle, Black Horse, Two Rivers, Gold Tooth, Good Blanket, Good Bear, Bear Shield, Yellow Man, Blind Man, Roan Horse, Belly Mule, Ballard, Begay, Yazzie. We are Dixon, Livingston, Tsozi, Nelson, Oxendine, Harjo, Armstrong, Mills, Tall Chief, Banks, Rogers, Bitsilly, Belcourt, Means, Good Feather, Bad Feather, Little Feather, Red Feather. Apparent death. We won't have come expecting gunfire, a shooter. As many times as it happens, as we see it happen on our screens, we still walk around in our lives thinking, no, not us. That happens to them. The people on the other side of the screen, the victims, their families. We don't know those people. We don't even know people who know those people. We're once and twice removed from most of what we see on the other side of the screen. especially that awful man, always a man. We watch and feel the horror, the unbelievable act, for a day, for 2 whole days, for a week. We post and click links and like.